Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Antoine Roquentin is sick. To be more precise, he is nauseous, dizzy with disgust, at the world around him, or rather dizzy with disgust at existence itself, especially his own existence. The protagonist of Nausea, Jean-Paul Sartre's first novel, loafs around the parks and cafes and libraries of Bouville, or Mudtown, a fictional provincial town on the coast of France. In his 30th year of life, Antoine has returned from traveling the world and is partway through writing an historical biography of a minor 18th century figure. He is, no surprise, disgusted with his object of study, whose only purpose is to suspend him, even if only for a little while, from his feelings of nausea. He makes little progress. Antoine lives alone and is alone. He speaks to no one, gives nothing, and receives nothing. So Antoine is sick. He is sick of material things like wet paper and seaside pebbles, sick of the passage of time and sick of people. Okay, so not a pleasant start, but it will get worse. Nausea leaks out of everyday objects, coagulates around him, and drowns him in the what he calls the vicious puddle at the bottom of our time. In one scene, he bends down to pick up a piece of wet, saturated paper to roll into tiny balls, but he can't work up the gumption. He can't abide being touched. Touching, you see, is to be touched. A sweet sickness. This sickness leaks into Antoine from certain inanimate objects. And he's not at first entirely certain about what precisely it is that he's trying to avoid. For instance, when he's careful not to look directly at an ordinary glass of beer for 30 minutes. But as the novel unfolds, he gradually concludes that existence itself is what disgusts him. He resolves that rather than touch and be touched, it is better to slip between objects, avoiding them as much as possible. Only one thing is certain for him. I exist, he says to himself. The world exists, and I know that the world exists. That's all. This nausea also spills out of time itself. It seems to come around about 3 o'clock when he says it's always too late or too early for anything you want to do. He yawns and resolves to wait until nightfall when he thinks the objects and I will come out of limbo. But passing the time does not come so easily to him. He worries to himself that time is too large. It can't be filled up. Everything you plunge into it is stretched and disintegrates. And perhaps this is a good way to describe the effects of Antoine's nausea upon him. He has been plunged into time and has turned out stretched and disintegrated on the other side. He is stretched out in space and time. From his apartment window, he watches an old woman walking. He says that he sees the future. He anticipates her steps. He thinks that time is laid bare, but this too makes him sick, because he realizes that time has already been there for a long time. It seems as though time is at bottom, nothing at all for him. Nothing happens when you live. There are no beginnings. Days are tacked onto days without rhyme or reason, an interminable, monotonous addition. So much for time. The closest thing that Antoine has to a friend in the novel is a man whom he derisively calls the self-taught man. Himself a companionless humanist who is slowly reading through a library's catalog alphabetically. The self-taught man, too, is a source of nausea. Once, when Antoine sees the self-taught man, he feels a surge of joy and relief, but remembers that with him you only appear to be two. On another occasion, the self-taught man stares silently and deeply into Antoine's eyes, and Antoine considers returning the gaze, but refuses, thinking to himself, I don't want any communion of souls. I haven't fallen that low. Over a meal, the self-taught man drones on to Antoine about humanism, about the importance of loving humankind without loving particular human beings. Antoine feels pity for the self-taught man whose brain has been poisoned and who is ignorant of his own deep-seated loneliness. Antoine feels angry, but decides that it's not up to him to open the self-taught man's eyes to his own enlightened existential disgust. He concludes to himself over a plate of chalky camembert cheese, "People, you must love people. Men are admirable. I want to vomit." Antoine's half-entertained solution for his nausea is adventure. Adventure thrusts Antoine into the present moment. "I am myself and I am here," he declares. Adventure gives him the sense that he is part of a story with a beginning, middle, and end. It links moments together. At the end of one Sunday, he glimpses a waitress, and though her melancholy smile reminds him of the odor of violets given off by a decomposing body, or maybe perhaps because of this fact, he feels at once that he is a complete and static whole with his surroundings. But as soon as he walks out of the cafe and onto the street, he is thrown back into bitter regret for his adventure. An adventure comes and goes as it pleases. As quickly as it uplifts him, it leaves him empty with the only lesson that he has wasted his life. I won't spoil the ending of this novel, though I don't think there's really too much to spoil. Later, though, I'd like to return to Antoine and discuss why some people say that acedia is a predominant vice or sin of our age. But for now, before we all settle into a murky puddle of despair, I'd like to take us out of the world of French existentialism and away from Sartre. So, sigh of relief. Okay. And bring us instead to the Egyptian desert of the 4th century. There, too, we find people who lived alone and spoke very little. They, like our friend Antoine, were forced to reckon with the profound boredom that threatens to wipe out all virtues, including charity and even being itself. One of the things that I'd like to notice as we explore this monastic tradition is that vices do not emerge under neutral conditions. Rather, they emerge under certain social conditions. Namely, there are beings whose purpose it is to educate and train human beings in vices, or we could say tempt them to these vices. This is not the end of the story, though. Vice is not a necessary fact in every case. Free will is decisive in the acceptance or rejection of this education or training. A true discernment of the nature of this training also is essential to the free exercise of our wills. So for the remainder of this talk, I'd like to come to terms with this social dimension by way of the monastic tradition. The most important figure in our story just now is Evagrius of Pontus, and I'll leave St. Thomas Aquinas to Sister Anna tomorrow. Evagrius is important because he is the first author to give a written account of this vice of acedia. His insightful description of the malady could serve for us as a counterpoint to Sartre, I think. To begin, I'd like to briefly discuss the context of the Egyptian desert in which acedia emerged as a category. Next, I'll present again briefly Evagrius's system of 8 demons or vices or thoughts. Finally, we'll consider his portrait of acedia itself and draw some conclusions about its contemporary manifestations. Evagrius reports that the demon of acedia afflicts solitaries or anchorites or hermits most of all. After our time with Antoine, perhaps this is not so surprising. Boredom, melancholy, ennui, nausea, these states have a habit of turning up when one is alone with a task that can only be completed alone. How much more should it pose a difficulty to those who live alone and spend most of their time alone? The solitaries of the Egyptian desert were distinguished from monks who lived in communities. The solitaries themselves did have a community, but from a distance. That is, they lived in individual huts or cells half buried in the ground at the edge of eyesight. So you could step out of your cell and look on the horizon and see a handful of other huts or cells. On Sundays, though they would gather for a common liturgy. Most of their lives, though, was spent in these cells, alternating between periods of manual labor. A favorite was basket weaving to support themselves, and prayers, especially psalms, the reading of scripture, and what we would call mental or contemplative prayer. They did, in addition to all this, have a rich tradition of exchange, especially in the form of discipleship, and we'll hear more about that in a later talk. One of the recurring themes of the Sayings of the Desert Fathers, which records these relationships of discipleship, is the encounter with demons, those beings who tempt us to vices. Evagrius himself teaches that demons attack those in the world in an indirect way through things, and attack those in the desert more directly through thoughts. Since in the desert, the solitaries are deprived of things. I wouldn't want us to get the wrong impression here, though. The idea is not as cut and dry as Evagrius presents it, that we in the world have a disordered attachment to things only, and monks in the desert have disordered attachments to thoughts only. Rather, the solitude of the desert gave these anchorites wide expanses of time for thought, and it also deprived them of things. So the demons had a narrower band of opportunity to attack them. They had to approach them in a more direct way. We might go further and notice that, in a sense, today many people live a bifurcated existence, half solitary, half secular. More than ever, people in the world spend time alone. The weakening of social bonds and institutions means that many are left to private occupations, private hobbies, and private interests. If they have friends with whom they share something in common, these friends might be manifested exclusively as digital simulacra on monitor, tablet, or phone. And so it is natural, even if it might not be desirable, that we spend more time ruminating on our thoughts. We ruminate on our memories, on mistakes we've made. We ruminate on our futures with anxiety about what could or will or must go wrong. Evagrius's experience in the desert taught him the habitual patterns of demons: when they attack, when they propose this or that temptation and not the other one, and in what order the attacks appear. He used his philosophical education to order and arrange these patterns for the sake of his own disciples and later readers. In his writings, he teaches that if one can recognize the demonic patterns of temptation, their power is deprived, since this power teeters on the uncertain foundation of deception. When the deception is unveiled, the force of the temptation is lost. So this gives us good reason, I think, to try to get a grip on what the strategy is. Evagrius perceives a pattern of 8 principal demons, thoughts or vices. Since he freely alternates between these 3 designations, demons, thoughts, or vices, I'll explain them here. Particular demons tempt people to particular vices by suggesting particular thoughts. The demon is the active agent. What the demon desires is that his victim, his target, give up the practice of virtues and cease from prayer. Why he desires this is a question for another time, but how he achieves this desire is through thoughts. Evagrius teaches that demons can insinuate thoughts into human minds. They can't read minds. God alone is the knower of hearts, but they can read bodies. They can watch posture, facial expression, and actions. What does the target do first? What does he do second? What third? When he does something different second, what further third thing follows the new second thing, and so on. On the basis of this data, the demons insinuate the right thought at the right time to achieve the right effect. Ultimately, what each demon aims for is an unstable but enduring state of vice. A particular demon insinuates a particular thought. The thought is accepted, personally appropriated, and repeatedly acted upon, and then it becomes a second nature, a vice, if all goes well for the demon. For the demon, this is passive income. Now the demon doesn't have to labor to tempt at all. His victim does all the work for him. His victim exploits himself. The list of the eight is familiar: gluttony, lust, avarice, sadness, anger, acedia, vainglory, and pride. This list is a source of the familiar seven deadly sins tradition. I won't bore you with an analysis of how this list changes in the tradition and why it gets reversed. Oh, now I'm boring you. Rather, to get to acedia, I will show you how Evagrius himself analyzes the list. He assigns each of the eight to particular parts of the tripartite soul: to the desiring or concupiscible part of the soul, to the angry or irascible part, and to the rational part, or the mind. The first three, gluttony, lust, avarice, belong to the concupiscible, the desiring part. Let's see. The next one, sadness, can emerge from either the irascible or the desiring part. Anger belongs, of course, to the irascible part, to the angry part, or the angering part. And the final two, vainglory and pride, belong to the rational part. To reiterate from earlier, Evagrius proposes that there are separate demons for each of these vices: a demon of gluttony, a demon of vainglory, and so forth. And they all work together, even though they have no common polity. They do have a common goal: to stop virtue, sow vice, and prevent prayer. There are various patterns in which these eight can be combined. Either after one, that is the monk, has succeeded or failed. So let's take success first as an example. A monk has advanced far in the life of virtue. He has conquered his attachment to food, sexual desire, and wealth. He has become gentle, and so overcome the temptation to wrath. And suddenly, he gets a feeling, a good feeling. The feeling is, I'm pretty great. Everything is smooth. Vices wither at his glance. Difficulties are endured, and they really do hurt sometimes, but it also feels good to grow. And then the thought occurs to him, maybe I don't need God for this. Evagrius identifies this thought as pride. When pride wins out, the monk is thrown back to square one, back to gluttony, lust, and avarice. But what makes acedia a distinct vice? Acedia, at least for Evagrius, is unique because it is all-encompassing and holistic. When I listed off the other demons in accordance with one or two of the three parts of the soul earlier, I failed to mention acedia. Why? Well, I omitted acedia because it is an attack on the whole soul, rational and irrational, even extending to the body. Evagrius calls it, for this reason, a mixed or complex thought. Some demons appeal to what is irrational in us, what we share with subrational animals, so anger and desire, while others appeal only to what is rational in us, our minds or our intellects. But acedia appeals to both, or all three. All at once, it is a failure of desire, a failure of anger, and a failure of reason, and even a failure of being at all. For this reason, it is an especially destructive vice. Evagrius calls it the most oppressive of all the demons. Let's now follow Evagrius in depth through his exploration of this vice. It begins with a complex exchange of hatreds and desires. The rational part of the soul then swoops in at the end to justify and expand upon these hatreds and desires, and they all fall together in a heap. The first step for the demons is to color the monk's perception of time, just like Antoine. But before we see how they do this, we have to know how the monastic day was ordered. From a bodily perspective, the most attention-grabbing hour was 3 p.m. when the solitaries took their single daily meal. Thus, the demon of acedia is the noonday demon. He comes in the doldrums between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. when the sun is high and blisteringly hot. He makes this time seem 50 hours long, Evagrius says, and he does this by making the monk more aware of the passage of time. He suggests the monk that he look out the window to track the course of the sun. I've prayed 26 psalms, and I'm just finished weaving my third basket. Surely it must be 2:30. Oh,
It's only 11:15.
Evagrius even mentions, based on personal experience, that this demon compels the monk to flip through his book to count the number of pages until the end. I don't know if that's familiar to you. From the demon's perspective, this is an opportune strategy. The middle of the day, unlike the beginning or the end, is able to be more easily unmoored, unfixed, and indefinite. In the beginning, there's momentum from, and at the end, there's momentum towards. In the middle, there's just the middle going on and on and on and on. Time in this state of mind becomes false and hateful. Time is something that if you could, you would make pass from existence entirely. You would pass the time. But born from this hatred is a desire for another time, a better time. What if now weren't now, basket weaving time? What if now was later, lunchtime? Evagrius moves from the hatred of time to the hatred of place, activity, and people. The demon of acedia, he says, instills a dislike for the place and for his state of life, for manual labor, and also the idea that love has disappeared from among the brothers, and there is no one to console him. And should there be someone during those days who has offended the monk, this too the demon uses to add further dislike of the place. We want to notice a few things here. First, this description is really an unfolding of the description of time earlier. What is it to hate time? How can you hate time? It has to be a hatred of your time. You don't hate someone else's time. No one wakes up in the morning in a dreadful sweat about the time on the eve of Louis IX's failed crusade. If you dislike time, it is because you dislike your place, you dislike your responsibilities, and you dislike your people. The thoughts go something like this. Why do I have to do this today, here, and with these people? The place isn't any good. The weather was nice when I got here in August, but it keeps raining. I'm not making any progress in my work. And the people, well, the people, as far as I'm concerned, used to be a lot better than they are now. And I'm starting to wonder whether they were any good in the first place. And maybe the only reason that they seemed good at the start was that they were temporarily enthusiastic about getting something out of it for themselves. And now that a sacrifice is required of them, they don't really seem so generous after all, especially when I'm having such a hard time with boredom and also the weather and my sinuses. Added to all that, not really liking any of these people anymore anyways. And thus is born a desire that mirrors the desire we observed before. I hate this place, this responsibility, and these people. I want that place, that responsibility, and those people. Desire swoops in to balance hatred. The hatred and avoidance of what is particular and proximate is the threshold of a desire for what is abstract and remote. But what about the rational part of the soul? In the first place, as far as the demons are concerned, it has a role in generating fantasies of an alternative reality. We could say that the mind, the rational part of the soul, responds to the feelings of hatred and the feelings of desire first by decreating. What is experienced is hateful, so the mind erases it from view or tries to. Second, in response to strong desires for an alternative, the mind imagines, it creates what an alternative time, an alternative place, and an alternative set responsibilities and people might be like. Acedia suggests to the individual subject that he is the judge and executioner of this present world, and that he will be the architect and fashioner of a new, better, alternative world. Finally, Evagrius says, the mind provides intellectual warrant to paper over these hatreds, desires, and fantasies. For the monk who wants to try out a new monastery, Acedia says, God is, after all, a bodiless being. So it doesn't make a difference one way or the other where he is worshipped. The vital thing is that he is worshipped. Or, God gave me a specific set of gifts and talents. If I'm going to make good use of them, if I'm not to be accused of bearing them, I really need to go somewhere else, not where people are better exactly, but where they're more suited to me, somewhere where I can really be of help. Evagrius notes that this intellectual act of world creation may be carried out in frenetic activity, stretched out and disintegrated by his passions, pulled this way by hatred and that way by desire, the monk abandons his cell and proposes for himself any pious exercise that can draw him away from what he is doing right here and right now. These enterprises may be very good in themselves, visiting the sick, seeking out the advice of someone wise, and so on. But for someone afflicted, or at least someone in the midst of the affliction of acedia, they really only serve his own purposes, to get free from his circumstances. He goes to and fro in search of what Antoine called adventure, something, anything, to distract from the anguish of the present and to make time make sense. But in the end, the tasty morsel of the novel experience turns to dust in his mouth. Even if these acts of piety or this thought of a new life distract him for a moment, they pass away and he's left in despair. He is still here, he is still now, and they are the same monks in the same cells on the same horizon. The only difference is that now he is more than ever exposed to this demon of acedia. Evagrius describes acedia as an atonia of the soul. The soul is untoned, even unelastic. It doesn't snap back when stretched. One who has succumbed to acedia is like an old pair of socks that slump down your legs onto your ankle. Or he's a feeble plant that bends at the slightest breeze. When the wind pushes, he doesn't push back. He can't. All of this brings us back to the question I hinted at when we parted ways with Antoine. Why is it that acedia is the reigning vice of our age? To read studies of the neurological effects of extensive screen use gives one the impression that anxious distraction is the newest and most difficult problem that mankind has ever faced. Is it just the fact that we have screens? Is it something else? To begin with screens, I would propose that technological realities do carry with them the possibility of supercharging the stages of acedia that Evagrius describes. Consider the crucial moment between hatred and desire on the one hand, and imagination on the other. You have developed a dislike for your present circumstances, and now you are left hungry for an alternative in your newly created world. The monk in his cell had more or less two options. He could conjure fantasies in his mind, or he could leave his cell to seek relief outside in pious enterprises. If we take the perspective of the demons, there are two main problems with these options. In the first place, with fantasy, if the monk conjures images in his mind, he's going to need a pretty weighty dose of hatred and desire to carry him all the way through. Mental fantasies, while powerful, suffer from being intangible, vague, and ultimately, according to our senses, imperceptible. And then again, if he ventures out of his cell, he's going to be met with concrete persons who may pose concrete problems that require him to assume concrete responsibilities. The people whom he visits might even correct his acedia in speech, as often happened. From the demon's perspective again, these two problems are at least partially solved with an internet connection. The imagination hardly needs to conjure images at all. The brightest, clearest images to cool the sharpest longings are available at all times and in all places. These images have all the advantages of reality and unreality for the demon. Hatred for present circumstances and longing for an alternative do not need to be even very intense to trigger searching for a new world. These feelings simply need to be entertained for a fleeting moment. There's also plenty of material for the mind to whip up a research-supported agenda of hatred, desire, and fantasy. You can have, at a moment's notice, the average salary for people in your position in your city, job placement for a particular field for any college that you might wish to transfer to. Even the social dimension is resolved. Digital technologies allow for fabricated social realities with people who share your exact interests and perspectives, but who could never demand the discomfort of responsibility, not to say obedience. More troubling still, you may have noticed that the internet somehow wants you to do this. It doesn't read your thoughts, but like the demons, it watches your bodily motions. It counts your clicks. It measures the speed of your scrolling when you blow by content and when you linger over it. If it could want anything, it would want you to be oppressed by acedia. It would want you to be like Antoine, disgusted by your circumstances, thirsty for adventure and distraction. The more disgusted you are and the more you desire an alternative world, the more likely your scroll is to linger and your cursor is to click. You are all likely familiar with the oft-quoted citation from Blaise Pascal's Pensées. The sole cause of man's unhappiness is that he does not know how to stay quietly in a room. But what follows that quotation, to my mind, is even more interesting, especially in this context. There, Pascal humorously describes the office of kingship. The king is a person who is perpetually surrounded by attendants, perpetually appealed to settle disputes, and perpetually flattered. His main joy is not the feeling or the implementation of power or authority. It's not even sumptuous living. His main joy, the main joy of the king, according to Pascal, is distraction. A king is surrounded by people whose only thought is to divert him and stop him thinking about himself, because king though he is, he becomes unhappy as soon as he thinks about himself. We have all become kings in this sense. We reign without authority, but we enjoy this royal privilege. At all times and places, we have legions of digital attendants whose principal purpose is to divert us from the dreadful possibility that we might once sit down, think about ourselves, feel a little miserable, and repent. I think there is also a more general and more intractable problem that we face. A constituent element of acedia is frenzied activity, which temporarily soothes the anguish of the cycle of hatred and desire. But when the frenzy cools down, we feel adrift, empty, and exhausted. This is not new, but the street that leads this way may be wider and better paved than ever. The philosopher Byung-Chul Han's analysis of what he calls achievement society or burnout society makes this clear. Han tries to make sense of why people seem more than ever to be tired. Our work makes us tired, and our friendships make us tired. And not tired in the way that you're exhausted after wearing your body out with manual labor, happy to finally lie down in bed, but tired like Antoine, tired of existence. His diagnosis indicates that our weariness is a result of an overly positive emphasis on ability and possibility. From childhood, we are told not that we should do something, but that we can do something. We can do anything. Consequently, we are constantly on the lookout for new identities, new passions, and new dreams. But a perpetual cycle of identity transformation is not true freedom. Han says, instead, it is self-exploitation. This trap of self-exploitation is not so different from the one in which the demons hope to ensnare us. Demons suggest a thought, and if it is accepted and put into action, repeatedly it becomes a vice, and then we do the work of the demons for them. It is not also entirely an accident that we are cheered on in changing our identities and dreams. The more we change our identities and the more we transform our lives into project, the more goods and services we consume to make these transformations possible. And if Evagrius and Han are right, these transformations leave us in desolation, desperate for further transformations and adventures. Granting that this is not completely new, it is at least heightened. And I think that statistics about depression and anxiety may have a correlated way to bear this out. What Han says might well be true. The complaint of the depressive individual, nothing is possible, can only occur in a society that thinks nothing is impossible. I told you it was going to get worse before it got better, or at least I told you that it was going to get worse. And it's not going to get better just now. What I hope we can see clearly at this point is that there is a social and spiritual reality in which the complex temptation of acedia occurs. We've considered it in a literary form, in the desert, in its monastic form, and even in some modern technological forms. Coming to terms with the nature of this temptation is not particularly pleasant, but to see it in practical terms and with clarity is vital, is a vital step in robbing it of its power over us. I also told you that I wasn't going to spoil the end of Nausea, Sartre's novel, but I think I will after all. Antoine does arrive at a final remedy, he thinks, for his nausea. His answer, the key that undoes the riddle of existence, is absurdity. Simply observe and accept the absurdity at the heart of existence, and nausea is relieved, or at least it abates. At the end of the novel, Antoine declines to board a train for Paris. He declines another adventure. Instead, he settles down in Beauville to write a story that will guide his readers into an acknowledgement of the meaninglessness of existence. This story is, of course, the novel itself, so it's kind of self-indulgent, if you ask me. And you might have guessed that I think there are better remedies than this, so we'll explore some of those tomorrow. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.